We used to say this a lot around here, not so much lately for some reason, but if you want a good indicator of our economic future, bonds, people, bonds. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Wednesday, today the 29th of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. I am going to throw a phrase at you here as we get going, and it's going to sound like a lot, but we are going to walk through it real slow-like, all right? The phrase is inverted yield curve. Now, the regular yield curve is a chart of the yields, the interest rates of U.S. Treasury bonds, all the way from 3 months on the short end out to 30 years on the long end. And with a regular yield curve, the yields, again, the interest rates the government has to pay, on, say, a 10-year bond are going to be higher than they are going to be on a 3-month bond, which makes sense, right? The government should have to pay you more for locking up your money for 10 years than it'll have to pay you for 3 months. For the visually inclined among you, and yes, I know this is radio, but I'm trying to help you out. For the visually inclined among you, the normal yield curve slopes up and to the right. An inverted yield curve is just like it sounds when yields on the short end, 3-month treasuries, are higher than on the long end. And lo and behold, that is where we find ourselves today. The curve of the 3-month and 10-year treasuries today is inverted. Not a lot, but it's definitely not normal. And it's worth noting because when the yield curve inverts, it can mean a recession is in the offing. So after all that, Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson actually gets us going.
We have to be careful not to read too much into an inverted yield curve too quickly, says Kathy Jones, chief fixed income strategist at Charles Schwab. The yield curve has been bouncing around a little bit. It inverted a few weeks ago and then again over the last few days. And Jones says that's driven by a couple of things.
One is that the Federal Reserve has raised short-term interest rates over the course of the last couple of years. So those have moved up.
Meanwhile, long-term rates are moving in the opposite direction.
There are signs that the global economy is slowing down, maybe the U.S. economy is slowing down, and that's helped pull down long-term interest rates.
But the inverted yield curve does not guarantee a recession. Menzi Chen, a professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, has analyzed the data, and he estimates
the likelihood right now as of May 2019 for a recession within the next 12 months is about 40%.
He says if long-term rates remain below short-term rates for a while, or if the gap between the two widens, then the likelihood of a recession increases. James Camp is managing director with Eagle Asset Management.
If the yield curve stays inverted for, we like to say, 10 to 12 trading days, it's consequential. If the yield curve stays inverted for more than 10 weeks, it is almost a lead pipe cinch that we're going to see a significant economic slowdown.
Still, the yield curve is not destiny. Camp says even with a sustained inversion, the Federal Reserve could intervene, cut rates, and change our economic course. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
There is, inside the Library of Congress, an agency called the Congressional Research Service. It provides, according to its website, policy analysis to members of Congress that is authoritative, objective, and nonpartisan. So its report analyzing the Trump tax cuts a year and a half on, the $1.5 trillion deficit finance Trump tax cuts that the White House, the president himself, actually promised would be rocket fuel for the economy, bears a mention. Because the economy is growing at pretty much the same rate it was before the tax cuts, and wages have barely budged. So what happened? We asked Marketplace's Andy Euler to find out.
President Trump said the economy would grow at 4.5% after the tax cuts. It's actually grown at 2.9%, which is still pretty good, but it's nothing new, according to Joel Slimrod, an economics professor at the University of Michigan.
It has been doing well since the tax cut. It was doing well for several years before the tax cut.
Most of us are paying a little bit less in taxes, but Howard Gleckman at the Tax Policy Center in D.C. says the real winners are corporations. They saw their tax rate cut almost in half. He says companies were all of a sudden sitting on piles of cash.
They looked around to see what they could do with it, whether they could make productive investments in workers or productive investments in new capital, new equipment, and they decided they actually couldn't. So what did they do with the money? They just gave it to the shareholders.
And not to their workers. The president said wages would grow substantially and fast as a result of the tax cuts, but we're not seeing that. What we are seeing is companies buying their stocks back from shareholders. So if you have stock in your portfolio, you're a little bit richer. David Gamage teaches tax law at Indiana University.
Anyone who has a substantial stock market investment portfolio has seen that portfolio probably having done better than it would have absent the legislation.
Howard Gleckman at the Tax Policy Center says we also need to keep in mind that the Trump tax cuts didn't happen in a vacuum.
It may be that there were some economic benefits of this tax cut, but they were washed out by the economic downturns as a result of, for example, President Trump's trade policy.
He says the tariffs on goods being paid by American consumers are basically equal to the amount of the tax cuts in the 2017 legislation. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Coming up tomorrow on the Marketplace Morning Report, a little bit more macroeconomics, a second look back at economic growth in this economy in the first quarter, and we will crystal ball it for you, too, where the economy might be headed 6, maybe 12 months from now. On Wall Street today, way less bad than it could have been. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I'm pretty sure, well, I would hope anyway, that anybody who's been even half listening to this program over the past year or so has gotten a pretty good sense of what tariffs are. Taxes on things made in another country, imported here, traditionally used to protect one domestic industry or another. They've become front page news in the Trump administration, of course, as much for how the president is using them as for how he mischaracterizes them and their effects. But this is not a story about the Trump tariffs, because the fact is tariffs have been a part of this economy since the days of Alexander Hamilton. And what that's meant is that American companies have had to adapt. They've had to make and sell and buy and source with an extremely vigilant eye on tariffs. So what we're going to do today is tell the story of one company, a big retailer you are sure to be familiar with, that has been dealing with its set of tariffs for decades now, and how they have baked those tariffs into literally every stage of their manufacturing and sales process, and what that means for the stuff that you the consumer, wind up buying.
I'm Jeff Tews, Vice President of Global Customs and Trade.
Peter Bragdon, I'm Executive Vice President and Chief Administrative Officer.
At?
Columbia Sportswear.
You know Columbia, right? Outdoor and sports clothing, backpacks and hiking shoes, that kind of stuff. 6,500 full-time employees, more than $2 billion a year in sales, global manufacturing as well, but headquartered in Beaverton, Oregon, just outside Portland, which is where Jeff and Peter are sitting across a conference room table from me in a kind of a nondescript suburban office park, really. Jeff and Peter are basically the tariff guys at Columbia, or two of them, anyway.
Yeah, I have a whole team of people that work with, together with the designers and developers and merchandisers and with customs, actually, to ensure that while during the design process that we're considering the impact of tariffs.
Wait, back up. During the design process, so you are designing your goods to accord with American tariff policy.
That's right.
So you've got some stuff on the table there in front of me. Pick up one of them and tell me how tariffs are affecting either your design, your sourcing, or the actual manufacturer of that product.
Okay. Well, this is a woman's shirt, and there's a particular what we call a tariff engineering that says if you have a pocket at or below the waist, the duty rate in this particular shirt, it's a man-made fiber shirt,
yeah,
goes from 27% duty to 16%.
Wait, sorry. So if that shirt was, so that shirt just as a regular shirt is 27%. But if you put a pocket below the waist, it goes to 16%.
Correct.
Okay, why?
Peter likes to tell that story.
Okay, Peter, tell me the story, man.
Well, it's the nurse pocket. It's a nurse pocket. And for some reason, that resulted at some point out of Washington, D.C., a reduction in duty. So it's a prime example of how the real designers of apparel and footwear in this country live on Capitol Hill.
Hang on. I'm going to play that again because it's important and you need to get what he's saying here.
It's a prime example of how the real designers of apparel and footwear in this country live on Capitol Hill.
Here's what that means. This nurse's pocket we're talking about, it's tiny. A 2, maybe a 3 or a 4 inch zipper sewn into the vertical seam on the side of an outdoorsy hiking shirt. If you were wearing it, the pocket would probably sit right about at your hip. And according to tariff rules that have been in effect since at least the 1980s, but probably earlier, women's upper body garments with pockets below the waist, that's a technical term, nurse's pocket is just shorthand, shirts with those pockets get a lower duty rate than shirts without them. Specifically, as Jeff said,
goes from 27% to 16%.
It's tough to find the exact reason why that is. You can read our best efforts at figuring it out at marketplace.org. But the point is that when the rules were written about which duty rates apply to which imported products, women's shirts with pockets below the waist got an advantage. So that tariff and dozens of others like it got internalized into the way Columbia does what it does, vertically integrated, if you will. That becomes completely clear in a room on the other side of the building filled with prototypes and fabric swatches and pictures of generations worth of Columbia merchandise.
Tell me who you are and where we are.
You're in Woody Blackford's office.
Are you Woody Blackford?
I'm Woody Blackford.
Okay, good.
Yeah, so
that's
I'm not an imposter.
Woody's the Vice President of Innovation and Design.
And then you also have Becca Johnson here.
Becca, you're on. Tell me who you are and what you do here.
I'm Becca Johnson, and I am an innovation designer, so I design all the different various types of products that we create here at Columbia Sportswear.
There are actual designers like Becca, but Woody's team's got material scientists on it, too. Lab coats, petri dishes, that whole thing. They're working on new textiles, and that, in this company, also means thinking about tariffs.
I was talking to Jeff earlier about this idea of tariff engineering.
Oh, yes, tariff engineering.
Well, say more.
Yeah. Well, that's something, you know, a little saying I have sometimes, and this is particularly for the U.S. marketplace, yeah, is, you know, designed by customs.
Customs officials, right?
Yeah. Because there's this set of esoteric rules that we've learned. Sometimes we'll follow them in order to get a better value equation.
If I say nurse's pocket to you, do you know what that is?
That's one of those lower pockets with, yeah.
Well, so Becca knows about it, so I'm gonna go to Becca
on that.
Seriously. So if I say nurse's pocket to you as a design specialist,
yep,
and the nurse's pocket is a pocket below the waistline that mm-hmm. then gets a shirt a greatly reduced tariff rate, mm-hmm. what is your design engineer and specialist gut saying about that?
Thankfully, within outdoor, I'm able to use that pocket for a functional purpose. So we usually call it a chapstick pocket or a key pocket or something that aids into an outdoor function. So we don't necessarily use it to hinder us. We usually try to spin it to something that's actually functional.
I love the chapstick pocket. That's great.
Yeah.
But bottom line, you got to put it on there.
Yeah.
Because that's what the tariffs are dictating you do.
Yeah. It's been interesting over the years. If I add that pocket, I'm actually able to then up-level the style in other ways because I use that duty savings to then give the consumer maybe extra venting or extra something else. So I'm able to engineer it in a way where I have to do those to be able to get the consumer what I think they need.
Translation? That tariff engineering at every stage of the production and design process, like that chapstick pocket, lets her add features that would be too expensive to produce if the shirt was taxed at 27% instead of 16. Politicians and regulators making the rules, then Columbia figuring out how to work with those rules to its advantage, gets us to you. Because dry and minutely detailed as they are, the hows and whys of tariff law show up when you, otherwise tariff-unaware consumer, go shopping, which is what we did at the Columbia outlet just down the road from headquarters, technically the Columbia Company Employee Store.
I should get a job here, man. Look at these markdowns.
You don't actually have to be an employee to shop here, but you do need an invite. Mine was from Russell Anderson. He's the head of Columbia's retail operations.
Hi, Russell. Kai Rizdal. Nice to see you.
Hi,
Rizdal.
Let me introduce Lili. She's our GM for the store.
I'm Kai. Nice to see you.
Nice to meet you.
Also, Lili Long, the store's general manager. I asked him to show me around just
one
a bit.
Of my favorites. Wow. Swimwear over on that backside over there.
I did not know Columbia did swimwear.
Yes, Prana does swimwear. Does a really nice line of them.
There's Columbia stuff, obviously. Also Mountain Hardware, Prana, and Sorel, all brands that Columbia Sportswear owns.
So as we walk over here, you'll see we'll get into rainwear and outerwear.
Yeah.
So I usually stop here. You'll notice this piece right here is probably one of my favorites.
It's a raincoat?
It is. Yeah, well, it's a remarkably ultra-lightweight raincoat.
So it's $100 retail, $60 here. That's not a bad deal.
Sure. It's right? a, you know, we're trying yeah. to... let our employees feel like there's a benefit to working here.
So you're wearing Columbia. Are you wearing Columbia?
I'm wearing Prana. So you asked me my favorite stuff, and I was over in Prana.
Okay, all right. Who else? What are you wearing?
Columbia.
Columbia. What are you wearing? Columbia. Just wearing Columbia. Wearing Columbia. Wow. Columbia. It's like a cult.
Well, this is what's putting the food on the table.
And then I got around to the thing that I actually came to ask.
All right, Lily, you ready? I got a tariff question for you.
All right.
Do you ever have consumers coming into you, women consumers, saying, I need a shirt that has a pocket right here?
Not maybe in a specific spot, but definitely where they can have a small pocket for putting their keys, like if they were running. So, for example, we have a shirt right over here.
Yeah. Oh, look at that. There it is. There's the nurse's pocket.
Yep.
Except it's a pocket. Chapstick pocket or whatever.
So if they were going hiking or something, they can just put their keys in here. And as you can see, it's a part of the seam. So it's not like it's like bulging out or anything.
Wow. That's kind of amazing, actually. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks,
you can get back to work now and actually, do your jobs.
So, what's the moral of the story here anyway, other than you get a convenient place to put your chapstick or your keys? Maybe it's just that tariffs have been a part of this economy forever and that they really matter. They matter because they change how companies behave. They change what consumers can buy and they change the way the economy works. The global economy, actually. You can check out a map of where Columbia makes its products to see what I'm talking about. Also, a picture of those pockets we mentioned. It's at marketplace.org. Coming up,
the kids can live there, and then eventually the parents and the kids can swap structures.
Making the best of an empty nest. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 221 points today, 0.8%, closed at 25,126, down 409 at one point were the blue chips. The NASDAQ lost 60 points, almost 0.8%, 75.47. The S&P 500 down 19 points, 0.7%, 27.83. Canada Goose, the maker of those expensive and somewhat controversial jackets, swooned 31% today after it missed revenue expectations in its latest quarter. Staying with apparel, Abercrombie & Fitch fell 26% today after disappointing same-store sales. Columbia Sportswear, since we were just talking about them, down 2.25% today. We talked at the top of the show about Treasury bonds and inverted yield curves. Today, the price on the 10-year T-note was flat, the yield thus also flat, 2.26%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I myself am a straight-up coffee guy, but many others in this economy, tens of millions of others, have energy drinks as their habitual pick-me-up. And to them, the Journal of the American Heart Association has this to say. Researchers have found a lot of energy drinks raise blood pressure and can increase the risk of heart attacks. Marketplace's Renata Sago has that one.
Energy drinks are like liquid candy with a kick. They're sweet and fizzy and quite effective in giving people like Antoine Smith the energy boost they want and sometimes need.
I have to consume at least 6 within a day.
Smith downs different brands, popular ones like Monster Energy, which he considers lightweight. Smith started energy drinks 8 years ago in college. Now at 35, they're a part of his routine.
It was just like the thing to do, and in a sense, I got addicted.
Smith and others are fueling an energy drink market researchers expect will reach $61 billion in a couple of years. The problem, according to the study, is that ingredients like caffeine, guarana, and taurine may spike blood pressure and cause electrical malfunction in the heart. Sachin Shah at the University of the Pacific co-authored the study.
Each individual ingredient on its own may generally be considered as safe, but when you put them together, what happens is where the question remains.
Several lawsuits have tried to link energy drinks to deaths without success. In a statement, the American Beverage Association said energy drinks meet federal safety rules and already display advisories for consumers who may be at an elevated risk, like children and pregnant women. But Laura McCleary with the Center for Science and the Public Interest says the problem is the way beverage companies are allowed to compare caffeine levels when seeking FDA approval.
The companies use widely varying assumptions about how much caffeine we consume in other sources.
In 2014, McCleary's group asked the FDA to slap a warning label on energy drinks, but the agency hasn't done so yet. In the meantime, new energy drinks have rolled out, boasting more natural ingredients. I'm Renata Sago for Marketplace.
You may know them as in-law units or granny flats. In the regulatory vernacular, they're called accessory dwelling units, ADUs for short, those tiny second units on single-family lots. But whatever you want to call them, they are becoming an increasingly popular alternative for seniors looking to downsize from empty nests. They're an especially big hit in expensive places on the West Coast like Silicon Valley, where seniors are struggling to afford soaring housing costs, as are their children. Matt Levin has the story from San Jose.
Paul Boehm is the kind of guy who laughs at his own dad jokes.
We have a fan going to dry the drywall walls. Can you get that? Dry the drywall walls.
The 63-year-old retired school teacher is showing me around the small house getting built in the backyard of his San Jose home.
There is no light in the attic.
Boehm's unit feels bigger than its 500 square feet. It's got an attic and skylights and a really nice refrigerator. You can tell he's excited about it. But what he's really excited about is who will be moving in. His daughter, Daniela, who's taking a tour of her future digs.
It's really frustrating to be 30, you know, and recently married and at some point wanting to perhaps start a family and being in a place where buying a home is not even an option. At this point, it's paying for rent is difficult, to be honest with you.
The median price of a single-family home in Silicon Valley is $1.3 million. Like so many other millennials priced out of the region, Daniela started looking for a starter home 120 miles away in Sacramento. Paul didn't want to drive that far to see future grandkids. So he and his wife, Rosa, made an offer. They'd build an ADU out back, where Daniela and her husband could rent for $2,000 a month.
Our initial reaction was of shock, of in terms of happiness, of like, I can't believe that my parents are willing to do this.
Plus, she wouldn't have to stay in the backyard forever.
One potential is that my daughter and my son-in-law live there for a number of years, and then at some point they would move into our house, and Rosa and I would move to the ADU.
The Boehms are one of a growing number of seniors turning to backyard homes for multi-generational housing. Stan Acton is founder of Bay Area-based Acton ADU, the contractor that built Paul's backyard unit.
A significant segment of the people that are calling us, they want to have their kids close. Their kids can't afford to live close. So they create this solution that the kids can live there and that eventually the parents and the kids can swap structures.
He says 80% of his business is seniors moving their kids into the backyard or vice versa. Demand is taking off across the West Coast. San Diego, Los Angeles, and Portland, Oregon have all seen big upticks in applications. Prices vary from city to city. In Silicon Valley, they're not cheap.
It needs to be somewhere in the $250,000 to $400,000, $500,000 range if you're really going to be successful.
Why pay that much for a smaller place? These tiny homes can still be a lot less expensive than other downsizing options, like condos or townhomes. And they're a great fit for seniors with mobility issues, says Blanca Castro from AARP California.
Maybe you can't go up the stairs. So having a small one-bedroom accessory dwelling unit or second unit home could be much more comfortable.
Castro says backyard homes help older adults age in place, staying close to support systems that keep them physically and psychologically healthy. Of course, not every family can live in such close quarters without getting into conflict. Back at his in-law unit in San Jose, Paul Boehm thinks he has the solution for that.
The threshold there is going to have a sign, no fights allowed from this point in.
Daniela and her husband are set to move in June. In San Jose, I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
Matt's story came to us from Cal Matters and from the California Dream Project. That's a nonprofit media collaborative. This final note on the way out today, which you are going to think I am making up, but I am not. In a press release this week announcing some natural gas exports, the Undersecretary of Energy of the United States of America said this, quote, "Increasing export capacity is critical to spreading freedom gas throughout the world." The Assistant Secretary for Fossil Energy went on to say this, again quoting, "I am pleased that the Department of Energy is doing what it can to promote an efficient regulatory system that allows for molecules of U.S. freedom to be exported to the world." I did not make up a single word of that. All right, we got to go. The Dow off 221 today. That is 0.8%. The NASDAQ lost 60 points, 60 points, almost 0.8% there. The S&P 500 dropped 19 points, lower 0.7%. Our media production team includes Sarah Berger, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostap, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Holliday. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.